for Bird Note.
Volunteering at CJSF 90.1 FM is a great experience and is easy to get started. So I'll tell you a little bit about it in the hope that you reach out. As this station is run almost entirely by volunteers, you have a variety of ways to get active at CJSF. Every department can use a little bit of help. Arts and entertainment. Well, you can write and produce reviews, conduct interviews of local musicians. The music library. Acquiring, organizing, reviewing, and compiling charts. Public affairs. Interviewing groups, attending events, recording lectures. Public relations, postering, graphic design, and programming. You can host your own show or work on a collective. Production, audio editing, and PSA building. And once you feel comfortable, you can even volunteer to help the volunteers. So volunteer with us at CJSF 90.1. Email us at vol4cjsf@sfu.ca.
CJSF is looking for new volunteers to come in and make radio. No experience is necessary. You can learn to DJ, edit sound, produce news, make posters, and host your own show. Come out to a weekly station orientation to get involved. Orientation times can be found on our website at www.cjsf.ca.
Researcher Dr. Corinne Cash is studying the 2022 impact of post-tropical storm Fiona on the Cape Breton Regional Municipality. Thousands of people were dealing with multi-day power outages, a lack of fuel, and damages to homes and property. Winds gusted up to 140 kilometers an hour and peaked at 160 in some areas, resulting in cracked power poles and uprooted trees. Cash tells Coast Radio that the community was unrecognizable after the storm.
It was like a disaster zone here in Cape Breton. It felt to me like almost like a developing country. It was hit so bad.
Cash has put together a survey for residents to share their experiences of Fiona to give a clearer picture of where government is needed after a storm such as that. Cash says even though the storm was 3 years ago, people should be prepared for similar events because of climate change.
Well, we know that these hurricanes are going to happen more frequently and intensely. And so we want to find out what happened with Hurricane Fiona because it was so extreme at the time to see how people recovered and order to recommend ways that people can be better prepared in the future.
Cash says she hopes the research will highlight that there are different levels of financial ability for people cleaning up after a storm, especially with extended power outages. She says although some government financial support is available for some people, others still struggle to replace spoiled food or fix their homes.
Even if people were, you know, somewhat comfortable, middle class, they were still impacted economically because most people have a little bit of a cushion, but the cushion for financial cushion, but the cushion required for Hurricane Fiona was pretty intense. It was extreme. And so being able to see how different people of different economic brackets recover or don't recover. And the other interesting thing is that if you are on a restricted income and the hurricane hits, what happens the next time when another event happens, like the winter storm that happened after that? Many people hadn't recovered. And if you don't have that economic ability to recover quickly, you get in this vicious cycle of being more vulnerable in the future.
She says they want to recommend changes in policy to ensure better recovery funds are available. Cash says people have displayed kindness, helping each other during times of distress, but it's not enough.
Government has to be ready in order to protect its citizens. And I think Cape Bretoners are known for helping one another and being there for one another. But that can't be all that we rely on, the good hearts of Cape Bretoners. Government has to be ready and prepared and be able to help those most vulnerable.
Financial strain during and after a storm is one thing, but Cash's research assistant, Carly McKenzie, says there are also psychological effects to consider. She talks about her firsthand experience when a similar storm struck Halifax in 2019.
I stayed in a shelter for the night. I didn't have a place to stay permanently. I couch hopped. I stayed in hotels. I technically was homeless. And so that can have an effect on a person, especially when you have other things to do, work, school, and it stays with you. Even when like a little bit of wind blows now, I still get a little scared. So, yeah, it really sticks with people, and it makes you... There's an emotional toll that storms take that people don't really talk about enough.
CBRM Deputy Mayor Elda McDonald applauds Cash and her team for the research. He says he'd like to see the findings when complete so it can be discussed at City Hall, and maybe the municipality can learn how to be better prepared. He hopes they can improve fuel distribution for residents, first responders, and municipal workers after a storm, because some people were stuck in long lineups at the service stations.
It was very, very difficult for people to get around. And of course, those people that were able to power up and help assist neighbors because they had generators, they were also needing to get fuel. And I know in my own neighborhood, the member two gas stations, you know, lined up for hours, just sitting in a line, waiting to get some gas. Jerry cans. Everybody was going with jerry cans, filling the car up and two jerry cans in each car. So it was a really eye-opening experience, one I hope we never go through again, but one that we have to learn from.
McDonald says fuel is a lifeline in a storm's wake, and if the supply is stable, the community will navigate through challenges more efficiently.
You know, whether it's the tree across King's Road and a truck needing to get to that tree, it needs to have gas in its tank. You know, whether it's neighborhoods fueling generators with gas to help provide some tea or, you know, something hot if they can, and a meal if that's possible. Everything, you know, our staff, our fire services, our emergency, our police, they all drive vehicles. And those vehicles operate on gas. So gas is a major, major factor in everything we do in responding to an event.
Cash is hoping the research will be completed within 2 years. She's a professor at Mount Allison University in Sackville, New Brunswick, but often visits her Cape Breton hometown of Irish Cove. For the Local Journalism Initiative, Bill McCush, Coast Radio News.
Thank you to Bill McCush from CKOA in Glass Bay, Nova Scotia, for that piece. And I think one that, you know, despite the fact that it is covering a very specific instance or incident that occurred in one specific area of Canada, Cape Breton, it is something that is important for all of us to be cognizant of. You know, it deals in to or deals with, you know, topics such as what needs to be done regarding organizing a system for distributing fuel, with future weather events, and the research that needs to go into that. And these are just not issues that are only going to affect one coast or one city. So it's important for, I guess, everyone to hear stories like that, no matter where you are. Coming up next, though, we have another story that is local to one area, but I think can be applied to here as well. This one is titled Recognizing and Staying Safe from Poison Parsnip. This comes from Rose Grisella in Carlsbad Springs, Ontario, from CJRO Radio. And I will play that piece for all of you right now.
Poison parsnip is an invasive plant that has spread widely across eastern Ontario. It was brought here by European settlers and has been part of our landscape since the 1940s. To explain what it is and why it matters, we spoke with Andy Steffen from South Nation Conservation, who holds a master's degree in biology.
So poison parsnip is just the common name for parsnip, which is Pastanaca sativa, when it escapes into the wild. So it's actually the exact same species as the parsnip you buy at the grocery store. It's just has escaped from the garden or the farm and has kind of become a nuisance. Originally, it came from Eurasia and it was brought over to Ontario by early European settlers as a food crop, and it did not take long for it to kind of get out into the wild. Because parsnip was brought over so early, it has become well established in eastern Ontario. So it's been here since at least the 1940s. Year to year, you can kind of see differences as it spreads to new areas or the weather is better or worse for it. Parsnip does particularly well in dry drought conditions because it has that really long tap root. So the current weather has definitely done it some favors.
Andy Steffen also explains why this plant is dangerous to people and what steps to take if you come into contact with its sap.
So the sap of the plant contains something called furanocoumarins, which is basically a chemical that if it gets on your skin, it causes phytophotodermatitis, which is a fancy way of saying that if you get the sap on your skin and then sunlight hits it, it can burn you. If you've ever heard of margarita burns, it's actually the same chemical because it's also found in citrus fruits like limes, it's found in celery and carrots, but in parsnip leaves it's at a slightly higher concentration, so it can cause burns a little bit more quickly. So the burns are pretty bad. It's not like poison ivy, it's not a rash, it's like a burn. So it can cause redness, it can cause really painful blisters, and it also leaves, even after it kind of heals, it leaves like a dark stain-like scar. I have a coworker who got a parsnip burn in May, and she still has the marks on her arms. And it can last quite a long time. So definitely it's something worth being careful with. So I would recommend reacting as quickly as you can. Number one is get out of the sun and wash it off with soap and water. Some people I've seen use hand sanitizer, which can be okay to kind of get it off your skin, like if you need to buy time, but it is not enough. You want to get it off with soap and water. And then they recommend for a couple days afterwards that you just try to keep the spot out of the sun. That doesn't necessarily mean you can't go outside, but definitely reach for a long sleeve t-shirt and put on some good sunscreen because you might be a little bit sensitive to the sun for a couple of days afterwards. If you do get a burn from parsnip, you should generally treat it like a burn, like if you burned yourself on a fire. So keep it dry, keep it clean, keep it covered with like a non-sticky bandage. And then generally, if it's a very large area or if it gets in your eyes, you'll probably want to seek medical attention, especially if it's in your eyes. Rinse it out with a lot of water and then go see a doctor because that can cause some pretty bad problems.
Andy Steffen describes what poison parsnip looks like, how to identify it, and where it commonly grows.
It's most recognizable when it's flowering. It can grow up to 1.5 meters tall, but I find that it usually doesn't around here. It tends to be a little bit more than a meter, but not by much. The flowers are yellow and kind of shaped like an umbrella. If you're familiar with Queen Anne's lace, it sort of looks like a yellow version of that, so with clustered flowers, or if you're familiar with the flowers on dill, it's a very similar looking flower. But the thing is, it only flowers in the second year that it grows. So in the first year, it's just leaves. It grows in sort of a basal rosette, kind of like a dandelion, but bigger. And the leaves are pretty distinctive. It's kind of hard to describe them. I really recommend that people look up what the leaves look like. The best way that I have to describe them is that they are alternate and pinnately compound, which is, I recognize most people don't like follow plant jargon, so I really recommend looking it up. Some people say it looks like celery leaves, but I honestly disagree. So definitely get familiar with what it looks like because it is everywhere around here. Even if this description isn't ringing a bell, is a pretty good likelihood that you've seen it. It really likes to grow in sunny, disturbed places. So think township and county roads, drainage ditches, pasture edges, fence lines, unpaved shoulders, trail edges, all those sorts of places. They really love ATV trails. The seeds like to get in places. Sometimes when I get home, I find it in my hair and in my clothes and in my boots. So ATV trails, it loves to stick to the ATV and then it gets carried to new and exciting places. But yeah, it's definitely around. Most people haven't been burned by it, probably because it has to be the sap. But I do have an aunt who tried to remove it without gloves, not knowing what it was, and she did not have a good time. So I think it's pretty important that people learn to recognize it.
If you need to remove poison parsnip, Andy Steffen advises covering up with gloves and long clothing to stay safe.
Number one is definitely identification. So if you know what it looks like, it's easier to kind of treat it with a little bit of respect because, yeah, it's sometimes I'm surprised by the places it pops up. And it's good to just kind of keep an eye out. The second most important thing is probably to cover up. If you have a nuisance patch that you really want to remove, I recommend just like full long sleeves, long pants, waterproof gloves. And if you're going to mow it or weed whack it, I really recommend eye protection because the sap can go just everywhere. And I've never gotten it in my eyes, but I hear that it's very unpleasant.
The best way to stay safe from poison parsnip is to know what it looks like and handle it carefully. This has been Rose Gresla with CJRO Radio, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
And we are back with Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. And thank you to Rose for that news piece on something that, while the piece takes a focus on what is going on in a specific city in Ontario, Carlsbad, it is also something that affects here as well. You know, poison parsnip, wild parsnip, is not something that just grows in Ontario. It grows kind of all throughout North America, including in BC. So if you ever come across it, you know what to do. Okay, before we get into the next segment for the hour, I thought I would keep it going with some local Vancouver music. This one also with a water-based title. So let's keep that theme going for this episode. This is Jan with Waiting in the Water.
Head in my hands, heart on the floor. I know how this feels, oh, I've been here before. I'm down on my luck, I'm kicking the curb. I'm clinging like honey to all of your words. But you got the love, give it back to me. Got the fear, won't you just let it be? But then you'll say that it's better if we just stay as we are. I think you're afraid to let go, and I think enough is enough. I've been wading through the waters, I've been crawling on the earth, holding at your hemline, but it doesn't seem to work. Don't you hang to
Once again, we are back with Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. You were just listening to Jan with her track, Waiting in the Water. And coming up next, we have another news piece that I produced a couple of weeks back. This one I had played before, but I thought I'd play it again, you know, recently. It was Labor Day, and I think currently within the... I was about to say news cycle, but it's news because it is a reality within Canada right now, and that has to do with a lot of discussions and fights for labor rights at the moment. And one of those fights is currently happening here at SFU within the Simon Fraser Student Society. This is my piece on the recent SFSS layoffs in violation of the collective agreement, according to their union. It's a serious allegation, and one that unfortunately I have not received any updates on, but until we do, and until I make a follow-up piece on this topic, here is what has been occurring so far. This is Danny Nazvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. In July of this year, the Simon Fraser Student Society initiated layoffs for 8 of 20 student service and operations staff positions, a significant decision that, according to the organization, was made due to budgetary restraints and the society's current deficit. These positions were represented by a local nonprofit union organization, QP3338, who have come out publicly to state that these notices of layoff are in direct violation of the union's collective agreement with the student society. CJSF reached out to QP for more information on these alleged violations. We then were able to speak with the union's president, Shaneza Bacchus, who provided a timeline of events regarding the layoff notices, the union's response, and the specific alleged violations of the union's collective agreement.
July 17th, starting at 3:18 p.m., we received by email 5 of the 8 notices of layoffs via email that were sent to the members. So it's a really poor way to deliver these news. And the key piece here is we were not given notice that these layoffs were being sent to the members. I can't stress how and what's the word? I'm lost for words, but it's contrary to acting in good faith. It's very disrespectful. It's unprofessional. And the fact is, they have a legal obligation to notify the union when they're laying off individuals, because then we have to schedule meetings with the individuals. So they did that. The emails went out. I saw these come in, and knowing full well that the entire membership is going to know that this is happening within minutes, I sent an update to the membership saying that the union has received these notices without prior notice that they were going out, and we will be addressing it with the employer. Shortly after that, the employer started holding meetings with those who were on site about the layoffs, again, without notice to the union, and without affording these impacted members their right to union representation. So when I received that information, I immediately went down to the SFSS with the intention of stopping those meetings, because that was contrary to the collective agreement. It's contrary to basic employment code. So when I did that, I absolutely did that firmly. I did it loudly. I have no apologies for how I choose to protect members. Well, I shouldn't say choose to. It was necessary to shut it down. I confronted two leads in the department, the HR lead and operations lead. Both denied that these were layoff meetings, but what else would you call them? I then confronted the SFSS president about it, and he claimed that the members did not need union representation. And I did raise my voice, and I said that is not his decision to make. This is their right, and we should have been notified. So that was that. That's what happened. And of course, I don't like engaging on that level, but we have to firmly and loudly protect the collective agreement and members' rights. And when they're being violated to such a high degree, we have no choice but to act in that manner.
Bacchus then went on to highlight one of the specific sections of the collective agreement that the union is claiming was violated by the Simon Fraser Student Society, as well as how these layoff proceedings should have occurred.
So we left, we spoke with the impacted members briefly, and then we left, and then we're here picking up the pieces after that. In terms of Section 54 and how it should go and how it should have gone and what we're trying to course correct at this time is, so the notice is served to the union, and then the union and the employer would then meet over a series of meetings, the labor adjustment meetings, to decide how this is going to go. We would talk about everything from voluntary severance, if they want to put out a call for those that want to leave employment and offer enhanced severance above the collective agreement, ensure seniority is protected, other aligning articles are protected. And then we then pick, we arrange a schedule to have these meetings in person to ensure that the member is there with the appropriate HR forms and information that they prepare, and that their union rep is there with them after. Because after this news is delivered, it is very hard for the impacted person.
Later in our conversation, Bacchus also wanted to stress that while she understands the budgetary restraints that led to these layoffs, for the union, this is a matter of legality and labor rights.
I will say for the, I just want to say that I do understand the budget, the reasons given were budget. I do understand the concerns that they have expressed. We know that in this climate, that is a management right to restructure and to lay off. We know we can't stop it. The goal is to ensure that it proceeds fairly according to all relevant legislation.
Lastly, Bacchus had this to say to SFU students who may be concerned about the impacts that these layoffs will have on student support services.
I really would. I would encourage a student body to press the council for explanation on this. I think this impacts them significantly from the fall. This is not next year. This is in a matter of weeks. They will see serious impacts to their educational and student experience. And I think they deserve answers. I think there's accountability here and transparency that's lacking. Yeah. And I would ask for everyone to please be kind to the QP staff, and because they're experiencing, there are things being said online which we cannot control, but online bullying and harassment has a real effect on people, and the staff are significantly dedicated to the work that they do. Members routinely give of their own pocket to support student-funded programs. Like the food bank, like they do really good things from the goodness of their heart because they're dedicated to their work and their work ethic. So I would really ask for kindness both in person and online to all staff right now. They're going through a really difficult time.
Once again, that was our conversation with Shaneza Bacchus, the union president for QP3338, on the recent notices of layoffs for 8 out of 20 staff positions in the Simon Fraser Student Society. Thank you all for tuning in for that piece. We have reached the end of this hour for Speak Up. Before I end off, I'm going to play one more track for all of you. This comes from local band Rosemary Ginger, and this track is, of course, titled Ocean in Between. Thank you all. We are 4 for 4 on the water-themed songs for this hour. Thank you all, and make sure you stay tuned for Democracy Now at 11 a.m.
The tide in the morning, you'll recede again.